We're still dealing with this circumstance concerning Britain passing navigation laws to regulate American trade, and Americans finding every tactic possible to get around it. In 1696, not 90, as is so falsely typed in item 21, so the Navigation Act of 1696 was passed. It provided the following three things in an effort to try to get serious about forcing navigation laws. It said that colonial governors were obligated to take legal oaths that they would carry out their duties. They'd enforce the navigation laws. That could be the basis for them to be fired and fined if they didn't. They took the oaths and they took the bribes and still did not enforce the laws. The agency, well, the handling of, in fact, I'm already wanting to digress before I say what I'm going to digress from, but the handling of trade regulations and the administering of colonies was always kind of a nebulous, unclear area of administration. A lot of different agencies, you know, I was talking to somebody about how, I mean, someone was telling me, because I don't know the great details, but like FEMA now is under Homeland Security, and what's going on in New Orleans is much different than what used to be by previous agencies. I'm sure that it's a Byzantine experience to try to figure out what agency went where and for what reason under the change. This is what was gradually happening over a century in Britain. As the king lost power and parliamentary ministers gaining power, it was unclear exactly who has the authority to regulate trade, who has the authority to administer the American, the Irish, and the Indian colonies. And quite often it fell to be considered a trade business thing rather than a government administrative effort. So different agencies took turns being stuck with the administering of the American colonies, which really meant no administration took place. So in 1696, to try to centralize this and make it work, and a new trade regulatory body was created called the Board of Trade and Plantations. And it was hoped that this newly created agency would consolidate and enforce these laws, which it didn't. Also, customs officials in the American colonies would be given an additional power or tool known as writs of assistance. A writ of assistance was, in many ways, kind of like a policeman has a pad of tickets and can give speeding tickets on the spot. If you could picture somebody, a police being able to go search a house with just a pad of, pull up the pad of tickets, write the person saying, write the house, write the time, and right then and there it's authorized, which we know cannot be done, or at least it's not supposed to be done here, because for a search to take place in the United States, what's supposed to happen? A judge ordered, court ordered warrant with probable cause, time, place, etc. Not something that can be whipped out at that exact moment, at least takes a little cumbersome time. And in fact, this idea of court ordered warrants went back in English history vaguely almost to the Magna Carta of 1215. In the 1689 Bill of Rights that we mentioned the last time we were together made it more precise that you did need court-ordered warrants to search a house. So the right of privacy, or at least the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizures, that's not always considered the same thing, but that was something well established in English law before this time period. So when this law, the 1696 Navigation Act, authorized customs agents to use these writs of assistance just in America, not in England, Americans would cry that this is a violation of their rights as British persons, as from the long-running constitutional history, which was correct. Yet what was also correct was they were the ones obviously smuggling and doing it, and so the law was targeting a true cause of law-breaking. It just was violating the traditional rights of innocent to prove guilty. It could have been a much greater fight had they actually used them, but since the bribing and the smuggling went on quite successfully, writs of assistance authorized in 1696 were not used until 1761. And when they start being used in 1761, that is the start of the trail of the American Revolution as a violation of rights. Item 22, in 1733, another effort made to try to gain money from the colonies and to direct trade back to the empire rather than to competitors. The Molasses Act said that for every barrel of non-English sugar purchased in the Caribbean from a Spanish or French or a Dutch port, 6 pence per barrel tax was to be charged to the customers, but instead 1 pence per barrel bribe usually made it cheaper. And if I could move to 24, then back to 23, that might, in my mind, make it easier to make sense here. Between 1733 and 1754, these three laws were passed, which made it illegal for colonists to harvest and sell woolens, produce hats, or to make ironworks. Not that there was a great industry for that in the colonies, but this was a protected industry for the English market. So what was supposed to be going on here is just as colonists will not engage in the woolens and hat and iron production, so will the British refrain from tobacco, lumber, and indigo and rice production. Of course, what we see is that all the trees were cut down from England long ago, and so there wasn't any real timber forest left to harvest, and the climate wasn't suitable for the other products anyway. So really all of this, given the image that certain parts of the empire are given protected market status, was really not true. It was wherever possible, the English home island was trying to milk money out of the colonies and protect its trade from overseas. Item 23, now back to this thing I was alluding to earlier about the evolution and change of who has administrative authority. With the restrictions on the monarchs after the Glorious Revolution of 1688, Parliament evolved over the next century into shrinking king's power, or monarchical power, and enlarging the role of various parliamentary ministers. But one of the things that also is true about this century is there was no direct order of authority, succession, and hierarchy. What really happened was a minister with a strong personality who could organize a strong coalition or alliance around him would be prominent for a while, be it the First Lord of the Treasury or Foreign Minister, Chancellor of the Exchequer. As long as that person with his coalition kept power, they're the ones that pretty much shepherded stuff through Parliament. So to say a prime, when you say the phrase a prime minister, it doesn't really take on a capital P, capital M meaning until the near mid-1800s. Prior to that, it's really who was the most primarily powerful minister of a post that had a coalition. And when my wife and son and I visited Britain a few years back, I talked to a British historian and asked him, why, or how do you guys explain the American Revolution? I felt rude asking, you know. How do we whoop you, is what I was asking him. You know, his explanation was one that I read again later, and that they believed this, and maybe there's some truth to it. That it wasn't an abuse of power, abuse of rights, it was just an administrative slip-up, because nobody was keeping track of which agency was supposed to be winding the store. The Americans just slipped right out and got away. Well, it does fit the idea that they're not clear who had power and authority in which area. But that's the mistakes were made argument that we always hear. And I guess they believe that. Robert Walpole in 1725 was, at that point in time, serving in close to what would have been a modern-day prime ministerial role. He spoke in front of the Parliament, and in his speech he said, as to the lack of enforcement of navigation laws, you don't have to know the quote, just kind of listen to the two-word phrase we'll mention. As to the lack of enforcement of navigation laws, he knew it, he recognized it, others in Parliament recognized it. In fact, it was a wise and judicious policy of salutary neglect. So that two-word phrase, salutary neglect, kind of came to mean that England realizes that on the one hand there are official policies, on the other hand there's also almost an official ignorance of the policy. And the reasons given were that they were engaged in wars with France, which is true. 1689 to 1763, naval wars and colonial wars with France kept the British government and money occupied. And when we find that the final war with France concludes successfully for Britain, that's when they'll start trying to clamp down and get strict with the American colonies. So now a new area of study here, item 25. Something from the colonial period that I find of interest. Occurred in 1734 and went to court in 1735. John Peter Zenger, a newspaper editor in New York, New York colony. He put out a publication which attacked and criticized the governor of New York, Bill Cosby, his real name is William Cosby, and said that Governor William Cosby this is not a quote, but this is an essence, was cantankerous, tyrannical, and unjust towards the citizens of the colony. Well, Bill was hurt, and hurt enough to sue. And in English libel laws, then and still now, all one needs to get a conviction for libel is that you can prove it was said and that you were hurt. And they pretty well had him. He had the published copy, and it was obvious to all, including the jury, that it was critical and mean-spirited. Yet, when Zinger went to court, he hired an 80-year-old lawyer named Andrew Hamilton that used a defense that by today's standards would be considered the common sense explanation, but shocked many there that such a defense was made. What did Hamilton say still left Zinger innocent? He printed it. What defense could one use if you had the paper right there in hand showing it? That it's true. That's an argument we today will take normally, but that was an argument that wouldn't have held up in English courts, but in the New York colonial court, the jury accepted it and said, since it was true that everybody knew Bill Cosby was a cad, that couldn't be liable. And that began a precedent, not just in New York, but throughout all 13 colonies, that the newspapers could print critical comments not only about officials, but policy, about British policy and British officials, so long as they had evidence to show proof and truth of what they said. And because of that, the tradition of criticizing policy grew over the next 30 years, and when the British start to clamp down, as I said, with writs of assistance and the Stamp Act and some of these other abuses, colonial press are quite vociferous in their criticism, and they're free to do so because the courts don't stop them. And one historian, you may have heard of a guy named Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr., really popular historian from New England. His father was a historian also. His father wrote a book about causes of the American Revolution. And he made the argument, I was very persuaded by this in a graduate class, he made the argument that probably what won the American Revolution was Zinger because of the freedom of the press. And the way he voiced this argument was that if you think about it, most of the headline-getting events of the American Revolution prior to war starting take place where? I mean, Massachusetts, Boston. I mean, you hear about sympathy concerns coming from the Virginia legislature or from Philadelphia, but as far as actual events of clashes between the British and Americans, most of it takes place in Boston. So it would be easy to think that's New Englanders, that's Bostonians' problems, that's Massachusetts people. It doesn't affect us on the frontier or down in Carolina, etc. So why were all the American colonies that may not have been directly affected by British abuse willing to unite together against the British? And the Schlesinger Sr. argument is because they had been, well, I don't want to say propagandized, but had been encouraged and incited through newspaper editorials that you do have common cause with your New England brothers and sisters. And so the newspapers, with their open, defiant attitude in publishing editorials, united the colonies against the British, which is part of that foundation for why we have such a, or at least in theory we do, we have such a respect for free press. That when the free press is critical of government, even when it sometimes exaggerates and uses false sources like Dan Rather and things like that, we still have within ourselves this feeling that a free press which is critical of government made us free and keeps us free. That's one view of it. As for libel cases, this is way off what could be on a test, but it's just fun to talk about. The standard for libel has changed, and slander also, in American legal history after 1964 in a case, that, not on a quiz, called New York Times versus Sullivan, in which the Supreme Court added this: if you are a public celebrity or a public official or an entertainer and you want to win a libel or slander suit, you have to prove more than just falsity. Now, if you're just an ordinary citizen that nobody knows, falsity is enough. But if you're a well-known celebrity individual or a powerful political broker, you have to prove something more than falsity. And what is that? Any guess? Absence of? What was that phrase? Malice? So you have to prove both falsity as well as intentional desire to harm, which is not so easy to do. You'd have to find, you know, a recorded phone conversation or a document or a witness that said that, yeah, I heard him claim he was going to get him, he's going to get revenge, I want to hurt this person. So you have to prove both intent as well as false reporting. Why did the court take away the privacy rights of celebrities like that? Because that's a hard one to prove. Frivolous lawsuits.
They put themselves out in the public eye.
That's true. So why should they lose rights for doing that? They might even be serving us and helping us, entertaining us. And then we strip them of their privacy rights? I didn't mean to jump on you. You offered. It's got to come back to, or at least I want it to come back to, the original purpose of the free press. Well, let's say this. Let's say you are doing research on something concerning the president, his handling of the war, and doing your best. You think you have it. You have your criticism based on factual material. Turns out what you quoted or what you cited was mistaken. And Bush sues you for libel just because you got some figures wrong, or a governor does. What will you not do in the future? Criticize. So the argument is that because of the power that not just political people but celebrities have, like when Don Henley says, let's raise money to save Walden Pond or save the whales or something like that for the Eagles, celebrities have strong influential power. And they, therefore, in theory, can move policy and make government policy. And if all they had to do was find where an error in factual material was found, they would have the means and motive to frighten and scare people, never to criticize at all, and our government officials would be able to be free from press criticism. That's the rationale. Do you agree with it? I do. I think it makes sense. Then there are stranger cases than that, and this is way off what we should be talking about. But the Falwell Flint case, do you recall that? Early 90s? Where, if I can get through this carefully, it's like trying to get through a George Carlin routine, if you can't really keep carefully and nice. But Falwell, a religious minister, in the eyes of Larry Flint, sleaze peddler, hustler, publisher, was too powerful of a political person shoving the new conservative right, the moral majority, in the early 90s. And so, taking a stab at him critically, Flint published artificial phony Smirnoff commercials, or Absolute Vodka commercials, I think, in which he implied that Falwell had sex with his mother in an outhouse. And that was the time he tried the vodka the first time. Well, at the bottom of that, poor terrible taste, which was true for Flint anyway, the bottom of the commercial he wrote, a parody, not for truth. Well, when Falwell sued Flint, he sued him on the grounds of libel. But the way Flint finally won the case was, we never intended to imply truth. All we intended to imply was malice. Isn't that something? Isn't that something that you actually could get free speech based on, I intended to hurt your feelings, not lie about you? And the Supreme Court upheld that defense and acquitted Flint. Someone later shot him. He's been wheelchair-bound since then. But, again, the court's argument is, in fact, one of the judges said, we held our nose and voted for the First Amendment. The argument was that, again, if you could just hush somebody up because your feelings are hurt, if you're that powerful, you could hush up all kinds of criticism. Well, where this discussion was originally was going was that John Peter Zinger made us free. last page, or at least last of the first three before quiz. Look at that one. Okay, going into another area here. How the philosophical era of the Age of Reason or the Enlightenment was the foundation for both the American Revolution and the new national government. Okay. The way I would wade into this to start with, this would be to say that different time periods produce scholarly philosophical ideals around which society and politics are often based. From the time of the birth of Christ up until this period, until the 1600s, most of what made up the political thinking and ways of Western Europe was based on the medieval traditions, mostly not science. It was mostly what was just kind of traditionally believed to be true and that which the church announced to be true. The challenge to that way of thought, to medieval thinking, starts with astronomers. And their intention is not to deny the existence of God or try to throw kings out of power. Their intentions are just trying to judge what is true about planetary motion. But what they start leads to all these other challenges. Galileo in the early 1500s proposed the same concept that I'm going to mention about Copernicus here, but because he lived too close to the Pope, he was forced to recant his thinking. Copernicus, a few years later in the 1540s, Polish astronomer would publish a book called On the Revolution of Heavenly Spheres, sometimes On the Revolutions of Heavenly Bodies, and he made the stunning claim that the Earth goes around the Sun, not the other way around. And that's exactly what had Galileo nearly beheaded and had to recant that. But I guess living in Poland farther away from Rome at that time made it easier to say it. And the times had relaxed somewhat. And his challenge of the church's view of astronomy led to a challenge of the church's view on many other areas of life, on social culture, on politics. The church did, in fact, I think it was in 1982, come around to the Copernicus view, to the Vatican II. But what followed was a series of questions, inductively, about what's the purpose and role of man, what is the purpose and role of universe, and for our sake, what came out of this in the Age of Enlightenment was a belief that all human beings have equal rights because it is the laws of nature. And that's the basis of the Enlightenment thinking or the Age of Reason, is there are laws of nature, natural laws, which if one perceives correctly, show that humans are all by birth deserving of certain rights. Those rights included property rights, the right to own property, free from interference by a state. They also included the right to choose who governs them. It's in that area that there was a great challenge against the divine right rule that we'd spoken of last time. So the idea that the king was and the king's family or a queen's family was chosen by God to be in charge of a realm or an empire didn't fit Enlightenment thinking at all. In fact, from Enlightenment thinking, the king is just another human being who also has property rights and also has a right to choose who he's ruled by. But if he or she temporarily rules somebody, they only do so with the consent of the governed. And that when they no longer deliver good service, when they no longer provide good policy, it's the people's right to depose them. So this is why John Locke, when we talked back in the Glorious Revolution, kind of seized upon this moment to justify the revolution as a way of enshrining Enlightenment thinking. That James II had lost the consent of the governed, and therefore it was the right of the people, the right of revolution, to overthrow him. And what were some of the causes of his loss of authority? Was his denial of equal rights, his denial of property rights. Other aspects of the Enlightenment that philosophers and writers and thinkers concluded, it's kind of interesting too because you could look at natural law and make all kinds of conclusions. Some of the conclusions they made were that men were superior to women. That's not an Enlightenment theory that holds anymore, but people say, well, you look at natural law and you see it's obvious. That's what they claim. So lots of times you can come up with a lot of explanations for things just by claiming it's the perception of natural law. But the conclusion of natural law was that people are inherently good and improvable. And given the right environmental circumstances, which would mean right governments, right systems, right education, that the best will emerge from people rather than the worst, and that societies can prosper and gain and grow if you provide the right systems. So that's quite opposite of Calvinism. That's more along the line of the Quaker thinking, where you're thinking that all people are potentially good and savable rather than depraved. And to some degree, that's where the Enlightenment began to challenge, you know, Calvinistic theology. There is an area where we can discuss where the Enlightenment was a challenge to the existence of God itself, but that's not really one that fits our needs, because the founding fathers did not embrace that idea when they came up with the Revelation. Another belief is that if you're going to be in harmony with natural laws, then in nature there's as little government as possible. So the government that governs least governs best. That's the Enlightenment principle. The belief of heavy-handed regulation in government was considered to be an artificial defiance of the laws of nature, which is why the Enlightenment thinkers and natural rights promoters were strong believers in the concept of laissez-faire. Did Rick write something more? Okay, you've got it already? I don't remember ever doing it, but you've got it, so that's cool. So the term laissez-faire, French phrase, means to leave alone or let do, was central to Enlightenment thinking. This would hint and suggest that ultimate Enlightenment thinkers would almost be like law of the jungle anarchists. They weren't. They recognized that there had to be some sense of order, but they were minimalists in terms of government. That doesn't mean they necessarily opposed monarchs. They just opposed monarchs that defied rights. If a government protected rights, protected services, regardless of the style of government, from the viewpoint of Enlightenment, it was a good government. And even if one was democratically elected and was poor in its services, then it's not a good Enlightenment government. 27. We've already mentioned Locke in his two treatises on government of 1690. Another well-known Enlightenment thinker, French writer of the 1730s, was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who proposed a concept and a book title called The Social Contract. Both the ideas of Locke and the ideas of Rousseau are strong in our Constitution and the American Revolution. The social contract works in this theory. Yes, the government that governs least governs best in theory. But the government that governs best is really the one that governs best in theory. And therefore, there are times when individuals left alone can provide the best service for themselves and their communities, but there are other times when individuals are less efficient than a community gathering. Therefore, they engage in a social contract in the community, or an agreement. And that contract would be where liberty and services work best left alone, leave them alone, but instead where government is needed, you will sacrifice some of your freedom, some of your rights, and some of your property. Even the property is always sacrosanct in Enlightenment thinking. To take property, and that means tax dollars, to take property or land from people, better be for an important reason. And the social contract would argue there are times when for security or for efficiency, for roads, etc., that you do trade property and freedom for services. So a court case that happened, I think it was over the summer, maybe it was at the end of spring.
They can take property for private.
We've accepted the idea that if you're going to make like a public university or a road or something, that they can take it from you. But the idea that somebody can run a casino that makes more money for the city than your small general store can, that's pretty shocking in regards to taking private property in order just to give it to someone else for private property. From a social contract argument, I see what they're saying, if it generates more benefit for all. But private to private transfer very much seems to be a violation of that spirit of private property that the Enlightenment embodies. That's why it ran into so much controversy. Of course, I don't remember all the details, but somebody is trying to condemn the property of David Souter, a Supreme Court judge, for the purpose of giving it to another private developer to generate more money than Souter could. Item 28, let's look at this person, Adam Smith, English economist. Smith was an Enlightenment thinker. He was also a member of a group of French, or he's not French, but he's a member of a French school of economists known as physiocrats. The physiocrats were the first, or at least in Western European history, the first school of economists. Economists who focused on economics alone, not trying to apply it to religion or kingly power. Their name implies what they believe. They believe in the rule of nature and the laws of nature. And so they would argue that one could interpret through the laws of nature correct economic truths. And Smith was not only a believer of this, but a strong propounder of it when he published The Wealth of Nations in 1776, which is an auspicious year indeed, because it's the year of the American Revolution. And it'll turn out that a lot of the American revolutionary dogma is based on not so much what he said, but the ideas he embraced. Sometimes the best way that I can explain this is by drawing a model on the board. And lots of times you put graphs on the board and make everything look true anyway. So let's try that. Here would be the economic model we're working. This is the price column, and here is the quantity bar. And what we're going to say is that this is that a seller, if you can only sell one product, no, this is right. Let's start with the demander. If we are a purchaser, what's going on in New Orleans is taking so much more relevance here. Gasoline. We, a purchaser, at $4 an item, are willing to buy, what, about one or one and a half here? That's maybe two, something like that. I didn't draw the graph correct. But the point is, as the price becomes lower, demanders, consumers, will buy more products per unit. And sellers work in the reverse. If the price is low, they'll produce less. If the price is high, they're willing to produce more. So that's just kind of common business sense. But what, with the way this map is drawn, can we conclude from this? There, that's what we're ultimately getting in a hurry. This equilibrium point is where everything the producer sells, it's a price they're willing to produce that many at, and they can unload and have no shortages and surpluses. And consumers are happy. They're not also upset about shortages and surpluses. Now, this is only true if what is also true about our model. Yeah, if you have an infinite number of sellers and an infinite number of buyers so that there is a free market competition available for everybody to search. If it's the only game in town, it obviously doesn't work that way. Or if you're an insulin person, it's not going to work that way. But if it's you have a choice to search around for a better price or a better buyer, then from that active competitive model, there's no shortages, there's no surpluses. Everybody, in theory, is happy. It's the perfect economic model working with just natural laws of supply and demand. And then this question arises, where was government in this model? Wasn't. So what the physiocrats and Adam Smith would conclude is that the government in economics, the government that governs least governs best. I guess they stopped robbers, Al-Qaeda and the Russians, and that's pretty much all they did. And they stayed out of everybody else's way after that. I had a Russian class last year when I said that, so I apologize. Anyway, so the point to be made here is that in 1776, if you are a believer in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nation concepts or the physiocratic school of economics, well, how much you feel about navigation laws and mercantilism? Totally, totally against it. Because if you have fixed prices or fixed quantities, then you're ultimately, despite your best efforts to promote the merchants or the buyers or whomever, that's like when they would keep artificial low rent prices for people in the Soviet Union. That may have been in the best attempt to try to helped the working class people, but it defied the laws of economics, creating shortages. So they would argue mercantilism is not a sound philosophy. It does not promote home wealth. It does not contribute to the mother country's wealth. It's just a rip-off scheme for the wealthy that hurts the economy for most people. Well, the Americans felt the same way. They didn't have to read Adam Smith to come to that conclusion because they're the victims of it. So Adam Smith's work becomes, later after the revolution is successful, touted as the prophecy of the American Revolution in the economic realm. Okay, item 29. Here are those conflicts that we mentioned, that from 1689 to 1763 kept the English Navy tied up and unable to enforce navigation laws. The first three have small bearing on colonial history, so we'll just barely mention them, so we can have something for quiz, of course. They are in Europe known as the first one is the War of League of Augsburg, which transpired from 1689 to 97, known as King William's War in the American colonies. It ended with the Treaty of Ryswick, and it was a treaty that is defined as an antebellum status quo arrangement, which is a term we will use in the future. The Latin literally means to return to pre-war existing conditions. And in fact, the first three of these, for the colonial sake, is pretty much antebellum status quo treaties. So after you've been through one, and especially two of these wars, by the third war coming around where you anticipate that the outcome of the war is no matter who was winning or who was losing at the end, you're going to give everything back or get everything back that you lost. What's the purpose of participating in such a conflict? None for the colonists. And yet, despite that, in each of these wars, the colonists would be badgered and pushed by the English government to pay taxes, to fit out militia recruits, to attack the French and Indians. The same people they would later have to do business with a year later, be neighbors with. They would be told they're supposed to defend the empire against the French and the Indians. And whatever land you capture, they anticipate they'll have to give back anyway to an antebellum status quo treaty. So that's why these first three wars have two names. And the first one we have, the War of League of Augsburg, was King William's War. The second one, the War of Spanish Secession, in item 30, is Queen Anne's War. And the third one, the War of Austrian Secession, is King George's War. If someone today was to call our current conflict Bush's War, as people did say about Clinton and Kosovo, and FDR and World War II, whenever a war gets named for the political leader, what does that imply? That it's their fault, or that the war itself doesn't need to be happening. So that's what these names apply here. These names apply that the colonists were disgusted with and did not give their wholehearted support to England's imperial wars with France. The English attitude is, what ingrates? Here we are defending you against French and Indians. You have no defense forces of your own, and yet you won't even bother to fit out militia and pay extra taxes. You don't even pay taxes normally anyway. You're always violating the laws and rules, and here we are defending you, and we're bailing you out. This always frustrated and angered the English because their attitude was, be a good, healthy, contributing part of the empire instead of a bunch of freeloaders. And the American attitude, of course, was that this is not a necessary war that affects us. This is your desire to take something from France over in the Far East, or take something in India, or protect against the French and Spanish and helping the Irish. This is not of any great need to us. One thing that is maybe of just some significance and interest is, in the Second War, still an antebellum status quo treaty, there was some change in the Treaty of Utrecht. And that is, Spain lost the island fortress of Gibraltar to Britain, and France lost French Acadia to Britain, which was renamed Nova Scotia. That Gibraltar part of the treaty will become of some bearing later when we talk about the American Revolution. Okay, so now we can move to 32. Here is a fourth imperial war, and this one's going to have a different bearing on the colonies than the first three. Fourth imperial war is triggered in the triggered in the British North American colonies rather than dribbles over from Europe. This war truly does start in the colonies. American investors have purchased proprietary rights to start a 14th colony. One of the most prominent of the investors is Ben Franklin, Pennsylvania. And their plan is to move into and establish an Ohio college. The problem with this, and I'm not sure these maps will show well, but this, if you can read the legend here, what this green implies is that all of this green area is claimed by the French. It's the area that is drained by the Mississippi, Missouri, Ohio River watershed. All the waters that flow into the Mississippi, according to the French, all the French claims. So that would mean that definitely near the Ohio and west of the Ohio River, in this area, is a French claim. There are 10 times as many English settlers as there are French settlers. So just in terms of ratio, the English or the British Americans could have always overpowered the French even in Canada, except that the French were good buddies with most of the Native Americans, the one exception being the Iroquois Nation. Outside of the Iroquois Nation, almost all the other Native Americans sided with the French in these conflicts. So when the French discover that there is an investment scheme at work to try to move into and take over Ohio and set up the 14th British colony, they, with their Native American allies, move quickly to set up a defense zone and along the Ohio River here start building fortifications. The one of most significance is at present-day Pittsburgh, known as Fort Duquesne, which is why Duquesne University is in Pittsburgh. Well, a force of soldiers is sent out under the command of George Washington, colonial officer with little experience. And his purpose was to try to secure that strategic location. When he got there, it was too late. The French had already begun building a fort, Fort Duquesne. He engaged in the Battle of Great Meadows and lost and was captured and was sent back to the British with the message, "You're too late. Don't start a colony. We're already building fortifications." But the Americans and the British had other thoughts in mind, and so between 1754 and 1755, they make plans to come back. Recognizing this could become a serious war in this hemisphere, American representatives from New York and New England and middle colonies meet in Albany, New York, and hold a conference. The meeting's with the Iroquois Nation. They want to know whether or not the Iroquois are going to side with them against all the other nations or stay neutral. At that meeting, Ben Franklin proposes that even though American colonists are quite fiercely independent, don't want to be united, don't want to be held under one central authority, this might be that one time when unification for defense purposes is critical. So he proposes reorganizing the political status of the colonies so that there will be a centralized home rule over the 13 colonies that report to Britain as a defense measure. It's voted on and it's rejected. And you may have seen different political cartoons at times where it shows like a snake cut into little pieces and it says underneath it, "Join or die." That was a political cartoon that Franklin put together and published to try to promote this Albany plan of union. And despite his popularity and his newspaper's popularity, it failed. So that's what the basis of that was. Now, why that's of some interest is that later, when the British wanted this union, they were very happy about the idea of colonists consolidating and administering and taxing themselves and supporting this conflict, and disappointed when it fell apart, and the war did come anyway. But the British parliamentary officials misread this experience, thinking even in the threat of French and Indians attacking, these Americans are so independent, they will not unite as colonies. So that fed into some of the thinking later when abusive policies were meted out on the colonists. They never truly anticipated a 1776 unification of these American colonies. Well, a year later, in 55, we're not in 36 here, the British attack again. This time the commander is William Braddock, Washington serving as a second in command to him. 1755, they attack Fort Duquesne. They fail again. Braddock is killed. Washington is again captured, arrested, and sent back with the same message. So one might think that 2 years in a row of that kind of experience would pretty much end a military career, but he turned out successful as commander of the Revolution and President of the United States later after that. Well, these skirmishes and these events here on the Ohio River triggered what came to be known as the French and Indian War. Didn't have a monarch's name this time. This time it's the French and Indian assault. And by the time it spread to Europe, it took on the name the Seven Years' War, since it started in Europe in 1757 and lasted until 1763. In 1757, as item 38 shows, William Pitt, who was serving as the most, I guess, primest of prime ministers at that time, he came up with this formula. He said, the reason that we are still in war with France, the reason that we have had such lackluster support from the Americans is that we're always running the empire on the cheap. And it's time to make the investment, to restructure, spend the money, deficit spend if necessary, put into place the administrative units to not only win this war, but administer this empire. And that's what they did. Pitt's plan was implemented, and it was successful. The French were defeated, both in Europe as well as in Canada. There's the famous Battle of Quebec, in which Wolfe, the British general, faces Montcalm, the French general. Both die in the conflict, but it ends up a British victory of taking of Quebec. So by 1761, the war in the American colonies is over, and finishing up in Europe by 63, and a treaty in 1763, the Paris Peace Treaty. This is not an antebellum status quo treaty. Much the difference. This is a redrawing of the Max Treaty. Paris Peace Treaty of 1763 will make North American claims shift from this to that. So what's most significant that we see here? Yeah, the French have lost. They retained fishing rights off of Newfoundland. They retain Haiti, in essence. There they go. And Martinique. And in South America, they do, yes. In North America, they've lost all of the watersheds of the Mississippi. That which was west of the Mississippi goes to Spanish claims. That which is east goes to English claims, including Spanish losing Florida. So it's a real redrawing of claims from a European-American perspective, maybe not from a Native American perspective. And it leaves two different attitudes that we see here in item 40. The American attitude is, well, this stuff is finally over. We don't have to have any more wars with our Indian neighbors or the French Canadians because they're defeated. They will no longer be threatened. So we can go back to life as we knew it before, not paying taxes, not fighting wars, being left alone, not being represented in Parliament either, but that's all right, because as long as they leave us alone, we'll leave it alone. But that's not the attitude. That's a divergent view from the British government. The British government is, we really deficit spent, if there is such a past tense of that verb, is spent. It just sounds more effective. Right? Sounds more like you spent a lot of money that way. We really went into the hole to take care of you Americans. And you owe not just for the French and Indian War, but you owe for four wars. So you've got a lot of repayment that you owe, and it's time to get this back. And this administrative unit that Pitt put into place is not just for the war, it is for the future. So the British attitude is new taxes, new enforcement, new compliance. And the American attitude is, what are you thinking? This is all behind us. It's good times again. And it is that divergent attitude in the early 1760s, which is the start of the American Revolution, which would be on our next sheet. Before we move to it, though, our quiz on Thursday, today's Thursday. Okay, our quiz on Tuesday will be on the things on these sheets. So, you want me to throw out some sample things that might be asked? I haven't made the quiz yet, so I don't know what to run at. But anytime it's a proper noun, I like to use that stuff, because that usually means no argument. Like, I might say something like, If the Plymouth colony was established by separatists in 1620, what nearby neighboring colony was established by Puritans in 1630? And you'd say, what two-word answer? Massachusetts Bay, yes. And I might say, demonstrating their desire to establish a role model community for all the world, what governor of Massachusetts Bay claimed we'll build a city upon a hill? John Winthrop, yeah. I might say, originally a surveyed boundary between Maryland and Pennsylvania, it eventually came to be synonymous with a social, political, and economic division between free North and slave South. And you would say, so it's that kind of stuff. It looks like it's a way to make points, but really it's the last cheap attempt to lecture that material again. That's what a quiz is all about. And it's good for a test, that way. If I have mentioned particular family names or companies involved in the establishment of colonies or particular religions, that's easy stuff. Remember, the proper nouns are what I go for. You lose no argument for that. Dominion of New England, Edmund Andros. Did a lot of good stuff today. Would it be sleazy to talk about things like Elizabeth and Utrecht? It would be, but probably. I probably never test or quiz over things that I breezed over in a hurry. But things that I spend a lot of time enjoying, that's the stuff I like to test. So, it's a little early. We could take a break now, or we could dive right into the next material. If the frown suggests a break. Okay. Meet next time, take a quiz, and start the new notes on Q4.